WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, as we continue our series on classic and current TV shows, we channel surf through a few programs from the past. Let's start with daytime TV's most popular talk show before the Oprah era, The Phil Donahue Show. It was broadcast nationally from 1969 to 96. TV talk shows around the country tried to copy Donahue's style, although the program was sometimes given over to standard morning show fare, like celebrity interviews and fashion tips. Donahue specialized in tackling controversial social, political, sexual, and religious issues. He introduced subjects that were then taboo on most TV talk shows, like homosexuality and transsexuality. Donahue used to describe himself as a chauvinist turned feminist. The key to the show's success, according to Donahue, was the active participation of the studio audience. In 1985, I asked Phil Donahue why he involved the audience in the program.
Well, first of all, I'd like you to believe that I was brilliant enough to sit down and decide to do all these things. Our show, like life itself, evolved. I replaced a variety show in Dayton, Ohio in 1967, and in so doing inherited an audience that had already received tickets for a program that includes song, dance, piano, and also you got to wave when the camera turned on you. Rather than dismiss the audience, why we invited them to come in and watch as I interviewed Madeline Murray O'Hare. I honestly don't remember how long it took, but after several shows, it was clear that what was happening during the commercials was in many ways more interesting and instructive than was happening between the host and the guest. And on one day, I jumped out of the chair and went into the audience. And it was really that moment is what, we didn't know it then, what subsequently made the program, different and, I think, absorbing enough to hold a viewer for an hour.
Were you ever at all disappointed that you were going to be on in the morning, knowing that the morning audience is always called the housewife audience?
Well, that stereotype existed, the prejudice continued, and I think continues today, although I don't think it's as widespread nor is it as powerful as it once was.
What does that mean in broadcasting terms when they say the house, you know, it's the housewives who listen? What does that mean to broadcasters or to broadcasting executives?
I think, first of all, it means a woman with hair curlers, perhaps sitting under a hairdryer and reading a movie magazine. It also means a very important marketing target, a person who buys everything that Procter & Gamble produces. And it also means, sadly, a person who doesn't have much of an interest in politics or much of a vision beyond the front lawn. I really don't think that that overstates the very damaging stereotype that existed within the broadcasting industry at the time. And we were very pleased. One of the things about which we're most proud is that the program demonstrated that those were the audience during the day wanted a program like ours for a long time, and we were just fortunate enough to come along and give it to them.
Were you advised not to do that, though? Were you told, look, Phil, wise up, you know, they don't want to hear about issues. You got to do celebrities and cosmetics.
That advice continued for quite a while. As you may know, we did not burn the town down immediately. We did well in Dayton, Ohio, but the thought of syndicating our program was really an absurdity. We had no desk, no couch, no band, no Phyllis Diller, no funny sidekick. We had really none of the conventions. Our program was also very visually dull. We had no spinning wheel. We were surrounded by programs wherein contestants were dressed like chicken salad sandwiches, or a man said, come on down, and you had all kinds of excitement and the possibility of winning a car, or in those days, maybe $5,000. Against this kind of energy, at the very least, some chutzpah. It made us very nervous. I have to say that I was nervous myself. Well, when we finally syndicated in 69, we got into 3 markets, and then 6, and then 4, and then 8, and then 5. We stuttered and stopped and started again. And on those occasions when we would get flat, we had a lot of pressure to throw pies, as you might say, to juice the show up, to make it more interesting. There was also a lot of resentment about a lot of resistance to the notion that the attention span of the viewer would be long enough to hold one guest for an hour. As you know, the book about television or the audience today is make sure you, do it in 6 minutes and then bring somebody, bring on the talking Pekingese. And we disproved them.
You hadn't really considered much about feminism in 1967 when you started doing the show. Looking back now, when you look at your early days of hosting and compare it to your way of doing it now, do you think that you were doing anything then that you'd now think of as being patronizing or chauvinistic?
I'm sure that I did. I was raised in a, pardon my voice, I've got a cricket that'll go away in a moment. I was raised in a world where men led and women served. All of the people in my childhood who had any authority at all were males, including the priests and the who said mass while I served. The adult nun who taught me, a woman, was not permitted on the altar while I, a child, was permitted to serve mass. And I think that I discovered probably too late that these experiences leave a legacy which do not depart from the soul very easily. And to this day, I think I'm struggling with those early experiences. I just had the good fortune of having a professional life that allowed me to meet people like Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and others, who said, among other things, that children in this culture get too much mother and not enough father. When they said that, they made me very nervous indeed, because it was certainly true in my case. And I think to this day I have a tendency to perhaps, I think patronizing habits die a very slow death, and I know that I'm capable of that behavior now and then. I'm not as bad as I used to be.
You're sometimes called TV's leading feminist or morning TV's only feminist or things like that. And I wonder if you have any ideas about why women on TV don't seem to be able to identify themselves as feminists. Sometimes I think that for a woman to identify herself as a feminist who's in broadcasting, it's seen as something that might compromise her professionalism.
I suppose you could say, I've never thought about it, your question provokes the possibility that that it is easier for a male to be a feminist than a woman. At least you get the possibility that you'll be, that your daughter will be exposed to ideas that you want her, that you, that remind her that it's important that she have, be an independent person, forsake the Cinderella fairy tale, be capable of accommodating her own needs on her own in the event that she makes a bad choice in terms of a relationship or a marriage. And at the same time, you get whatever comfort might come from the fact that a male is making these points, since all the years of most of us in my age group have featured males in positions of authority. Interesting possibility. I don't know. I think the point should be made that the fact that I am considered to be this leading male feminist is itself indicting. I embraced the politics of the feminist movement a long time ago for selfish reasons. First of all, I have a daughter. But I certainly can't claim to have the academic credentials or the informed historical perspective of feminist politics that a lot of other people who don't have to happen to have the good fortune of having a talk show might have. So it's really, I think, a sign of this enormous struggle that after all this work that these women, all of many of whom were out there early getting whistled at and having their sex preference questioned and who were really being derisively treated by a largely male press, look up 20 years after this wave has already been underway and discover that their number one male or that one of their leading male supporters is Phil Donahue. I'm not mock humble at all when I say that I didn't wake up one morning and decide to be a feminist. It's been a very difficult struggle. It's very hard to walk away from all the free services that women have provided me all my life. My mother never missed a meal, and I went right from her to a wife who never missed a meal and also dutifully raised five children while I went out and did what you did in the 50s. I got promoted and worked. I was a workaholic, and now I realize that in that process, I was not a party to shared parenthood, and I think that the losers in that case were my children.
You've written in your autobiography a couple of years ago about how during your first marriage, you know, you were a much more conventional in your attitude towards gender. And I sometimes think about how your first wife must feel now, hearing all this talk about Phil Donahue, Mr. Feminist, when she was married to, you know, pre-feminist Phil Donahue and saw the earlier
I think she probably feels, I think it's probably, it's a painful thing for her. I made it clear who I was and who I wasn't in my autobiography. It'd be better if someone else said this, but I think it's a reasonably honest review of who I was and wasn't in the early days of our in the early years of our marriage. What has happened, I think, is that media has, I think, in a kind of short-circuit way, presented me as the single father, who this, who that. Single fathers get a lot more attention than single mothers. Single mothers are supposed to be wonderful. Single fathers are little boys lost that you just kind of want to love, and isn't he struggling to do a nice job? What a wonderful guy he must be. I really feel pretty good about my single fatherhood, having presided over the household while my sons were going through high school. But I do not deserve the award of Father of the Year. I was scared. I really didn't. My father was a fellow who worked 9 to 9 selling furniture. So while he loved me and was a very civil, gentle, insightful man, he was, because of his workaholism, an absentee father in many ways. So I really didn't have a whole... I was a very, very uneasy single parent. And while I did struggle through it, and I'm very grateful for the relationship that I enjoy with my children today, I wasn't what you would... I wasn't the father that my billing might suggest today.
There have been local stations that have blacked out some of your programs, either portions of it, or they've played a rerun instead of carrying the regular show. And I guess some of the subjects have been showing an abortion, showing a birth. Do you approve of them doing it? Do you think that that's... well, obviously you don't, but do you think it's an example of, you know, democracy in action
or
the opposite?
I do. I think this... I think the syndicated... method of distribution of program material is the most democratic. We paid our dues for this. Not being on a network means that one vice president can't, while he's shaving on a Tuesday morning, decide that we're finished. Peoria can cancel our show, but I'm still on the air in Indianapolis. At the same time, individual stations can make a decision about what they may or may not want to broadcast. While it is true we have a contract to provide a program to them, they have no obligation to broadcast it. They are responsible for what goes off the top of their tower, and they retain the last final word on whether this or that program airs. I think that's as democratic as you get in our business. On those occasions when someone cancels our show, I do call them. I mean, I think I make it clear, look, you're the customer, and if you and I are going to have a fight here, you're going to win. It's your station. But please let me appeal this. We wouldn't have sent you this program if we thought it wasn't a broadcast quality. And then I attempt to engage them in a dialogue about why they did it and why we did it. And I think it serves to let them know that we're not cavalier about people canceling the program. And the next time they think about it, at least they'll know that we're watching them.
You've done many controversial shows. And because your show is on in the morning, I know a lot of people object to a certain kind of controversy in the morning because the children are home or the children are awake. Do you think that that's a valid reason to change the content to prevent controversy on your program?
I really don't, although this is a tough sell. You know, if you oblige me to consider children and their response to what I program, then, you know, you're going to bring me, distill me down to slides and organ music. We have a show that's by adults and for adults. The notion that children are sitting out there absorbed for 1 hour about a transsexual lifestyle is, I think, not consistent with reality. If anything, kids are bored by my show. Those who aren't in their pre-adolescent or adolescent years, I think, would benefit by it, because I think we present these sensitive issues responsibly. But again, I don't claim to be your most objective witness.
Phil Donahue, recorded in 1985. Coming up, Chuck Barris, creator of The Dating Game and The Newlywed Game, as our TV week continues. This is Fresh Air.